Hello and welcome back to another exciting episode of Challenger City TO. I'm your host, Ian Montgomery, and today I've got a great guest. Hilton Barber is with us today. He's a seasoned marketer and thought leader on the impact of culture in driving organizational success. Now, Hilton, who many might mistake as being South African, and you have been warned, has made Toronto his home, not once, but twice, and has been a powerful voice in discussing how culture shapes not only businesses, but also cities and the governance around them. So in this episode, we're going to dive into culture influencing our city, exploring the critical elements needed to transform Toronto into a great city from just a good one, one that doesn't settle for mediocrity by only aiming as high as bronze, and instead driving for a bit of gold action. Hilton's insights on the role of culture in fostering innovation, driving bold decisions, and setting ambitious goals are incredibly timely as we navigate the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead for our city. We'll also touch on some pressing issues such as housing, transportation, job creation, and discuss how a strong, supportive culture can be the foundation for addressing these challenges effectively. So without further ado, let's get right into the conversation. Hilton, thank you, because you said yes to something that you didn't really know what you were signing up for. So I appreciate people that do that.
Ian, it's always a pleasure to spend time with you. Certainly do appreciate your genuine, provocative style. But more importantly, I think behind that provocation is a genuine desire to actually come up with a solution. So heaven forbid that I can be part of that solution, but certainly always appreciate time spent with you.
I'm going to get that written up and stick it on a postcard and have it on my LinkedIn, because that's the nicest thing someone said about me all week. But I want to say nice things about you. So I kind of think of you as like the culture guy. You post a lot of really intelligent, thoughtful stuff around like actual change needs to come through culture. And culture is that big fluffy word that people like to throw around without necessarily knowing what they really mean by it, or sometimes not following it through. But I'd love to start with Hilton. Like, how the hell did this guy that we all think is South African, but actually isn't South African, now living in Toronto, come to be the guy that you sort of see popping up talking really eloquently about culture?
Well, I always like to start a Friday with a compliment like that. So thank you. I'm sure my mom will be overjoyed when I send her this podcast. In truth, I'm a career marketer. My career began a million years ago when dinosaurs ruled the earth. But through the course of my career, time and again, I found that when I was talking to clients or even myself personally, I recognized that there were environments in which I thrived, where I knew what I was doing. I knew how to succeed. I knew what was expected of me, and I knew what my contribution meant. Equally, there were times that I was completely lost. And none of those attributions could I find. Ironically, it wasn't very different with the clients that I'd worked with over the years. And I've had real good fortune of working with some well-known, recognized global brands and some fantastic Canadian local brands as well. But in two particular examples, one when I went to New York to run the Enron business, and I'll just leave a moment's pause there for everyone to fill their mental and their memory with Enron. I remember those guys. And 5 years in the UK, where I spent a lot of time flying between London and Espoo in Finland, working with a large global telecommunications and mobile handset manufacturer that we may all fondly remember. I saw very, very clearly the impact of culture on what those organizations did, how their people behaved, and how ultimately they showed up in the marketplace. So I've always been fascinated by exactly that. How do we have these entities, whether it's an organization, a not-for-profit, or a government, local, provincial, federal, where people gather to move an agenda forward and then act and make decisions in a certain way that either accelerate what they're trying to get done or impede and thwart their very best intentions. So for me, that inherently is what culture is. And as a marketing guy, I've always been fascinated at how does culture impact what an organization can bring to the market? And in the spirit of this particular podcast, how does culture impact what our various levels of government try to bring to the market for us as citizens and inhabitants of both this great city of Toronto, but this fantastic country we call Canada as well?
So when it comes to culture, as you've gone through your career as a marketer, how quickly did you really grasp this idea? And was it something that for a long time you kind of knew was important, but didn't necessarily know how to influence? At what point did the culture thing really come to the fore to be like, this is the thing that is going to be so critical if we want to be a great marketing-led organization?
It's an excellent question. I think inherently, for me, it was always through those two lenses. My own personal experiences operating inside a culture of places that I worked and looking back on my own career and wondering, where were there times that I was successful by my own yardstick? And there was no doubt that the culture had a significant impact on my success, not surprisingly. And I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast can reflect on their career and go, why was I so successful at X company? And why did I struggle to, because I'm still inherently the same person with the same expertise, with the same intelligence, with the same passion, ambition, etc. But how did it flourish at X and fail at Y? And I think everybody listening to this can probably do that triage in their head. Sitting across the desk, obviously, from clients who inherently come to any consultancy or professional services firm to seek help in either thinking differently, doing something differently, moving an agenda forward, the same thing would happen time and again. You'd sit in meetings and inherently you knew leaving that meeting that all the great conversation and all the wonderful ideas were going to go nowhere. But the energy in the room was great and people were excited about it. But inherently you were like, if that happens, there's a snowball's chance in hell. Equally at other places, you would leave a meeting knowing that everything that had been discussed was going to move forward. Because in many ways, the culture wanted and willed it to move forward. So again, that dynamic, time and again, personally and professionally across the desk of clients, I sat and went, this dimension is so vital. If you want to get anything done, even more critical, if you want to get something new, different, distinct, disruptive, transformative, if the culture doesn't want it to happen, it's dead in the water. So for me, and again, in the spirit of these conversations, we can dream a dream about the city we live in. Whether we have the culture inside the organizations that actually have responsibility for that, that to me is an entirely different question, but a vital one to answer.
So the best places I've ever worked have often had this culture of being quite comfortable saying when they're not very good at something. So whenever I went anywhere and they kind of said, oh, we don't really need to go out and speak to customers, we have tons and tons of research, was always the flag to me of you don't know anything about your customers at all. You couldn't tell me anything remotely insightful. You couldn't tell me the thing that makes them act or whatever it might be. Whereas when a client would typically say something along the lines of, this is sort of interesting to us, this is a black box, you kind of knew that they knew sort of what they were doing, but they really wanted it fleshing out. And there's this sort of thing I see when it comes to Toronto that now I think is a really good moment for doing something in the city, because we are getting better at saying, this doesn't work, this has always been a problem, we have to change this. Maybe it's me being too optimistic. Maybe it's me just being too hopeful that finally we've hit the bottom piece and we can sort of find our way out of it. But when it comes to culture as a challenger city, would you agree that it's really important to like know where your flaws are? And are we at that point where Toronto has that culture where it can start to drive towards change?
So I think that's firstly an excellent observation. I would suggest there's two parts to what you just said. The curiosity part, I think, is absolutely vital. Individually, it's a cornerstone, I think, of my brand, if you will. But I do think curiosity is a vital component for any individual or any organization at this moment in time. What's going on around us? What is different? What is new? What is fast approaching? What are some of the sacred cows that we've held onto historically that we now need to push to one side? But curiosity alone is not going to get us to the finish line, because again, and you and I have talked about this immeasurable, innumerable times. Strategy is one thing. Execution is the other. And the culture really comes to light in the execution side of the equation. So I absolutely agree. Being curious, and I do think Toronto is at that moment where there's certainly a groundswell, a screaming cacophony, if you will, of people saying, can we not be better? Should we not be better? Are we not capable of being better? I think is a phenomenal thing I see everywhere I look in this city. And that That energy is fantastic. We do need to harness it. But harnessing it and not executing against it just becomes a promise unfulfilled. And therein, I think, is where my larger concern is. I don't disagree that that energy exists. And fortunately, we have vehicles like this great podcast to help move that conversation forward. But if it's only ever a conversation, or it falls at the first furlough because we don't have the will or the culture to execute it, I really worry that what is currently energy will soon turn into disappointment and ultimately despondency. And that is something that we have to nip in the bud right now.
But when it comes to the execution side of things, I think often we can have really great intentions and we almost want to make the execution perfect. And this is maybe where I pick on Canada and pick on Toronto and pick on Canadian companies and their cultures. And I can be the bad guy and you can be the good guy here.
There's a first time for everything, yeah.
We talked about this over beers and coffees and the like before, but you have this thing of there's the good intention, but then there's this desire to be perfect and the desire to get all the ducks in a row. And cultures that tend to operate like that tend to be failing cultures because inevitably something doesn't go perfect, or there's a contingency, or there's something in the road that's going to get in the way. And therefore, because we can't do step 2B, we never get to steps 3, 5, 27. And it's almost that to me is a very Canadian trait of we want to try and be perfect. And in the absence of being perfect, we actually don't really get anything done. And changing that culture is probably the most important thing when it comes to Toronto, the Challenger City.
I would counter that slightly. And again, this is through the lens of culture, probably in its purest and possibly even academic orientation. Your culture really, again, we mentioned earlier, is how you act, behave, and make decisions. But how you make decisions is a vital consideration in there. And again, I ask everybody listening to this podcast to just consider a moment of how they make decisions in either a company they've worked at in the past or the company they work at currently. How do you make decisions that are safe for you is a consideration that every human being goes through every single day inside their environment. If I make this decision, is it going to open me up to ridicule? Am I going to be fired, perhaps, at its most extreme? Am I going to be sidelined? Or am I going to receive accolades and promotions and a mini statue in the canteen and employee of the month placard? We know, or we often sense and feel inside a culture, is this a decision for which I will be promoted, or is this a decision for which I will be ridiculed, rejected, and possibly fired? You know, and I would imagine at City Hall today, in Ottawa, on Parliament Hill, and across this country, there are a billion decisions that people are making today through that lens of, holy shit, this is a big and brave thing I want to do. Am I able to make it? And will the culture actually appreciate, or will they deny it? And that makes me unsafe. And I think that's the critical thing. As we talk about whether it's complacency or comfort or not wanting to move forward, I would suggest that's an outcome of the culture. It's not the culture, but it's the outcome of I need to make a very limited, a very safe, a very conservative decision, because anything more than that will be unsafe for me and the culture will not appreciate or endorse it. So I think that's a vital component. Is the culture prepared, willing to promote, brave, new, disruptive, uncomfortable decisions? If it is, we're onto a winning formula. If it's not, we are going to inch forward like a snail with arthritis continually. And that should be something we're all desperately worried about.
Who does it really well? Who do you look to as the standard bearers of those cultures?
Magnificent question. And one occasionally that gets asked. My genuine deflection of that question really comes back to this. At its best, your culture allows your strategy to succeed. So inherent in that is a tension of, do you have a strategy? What does that strategy require of your people and of your business and of your organization to achieve it. So it can be very easy to call out all sorts of great cultures, whether you talk about Virgin, Southwest Airlines, Patagonia, Costco. There are magnificent cultures, and people typically sort of bring those to the surface under everyone's happy over there and they do awesome things for their people and there's free kombucha and they've got bring your dog to work on Friday and look at how many foosball tables they've got. All of that is a distraction, candidly. The question should always be, do you have a culture that lets you execute against your strategy? Now, in some cases, that's going to be spectacular for your employees. I might argue, whether you like it or not, Walmart and Amazon both have cultures that allow them to achieve what their business strategy is. Walmart's everyday low prices requires a culture that makes decisions quickly and looks at every single line item and says, are we paying too much for this? Sadly, sometimes that line item is a bunch of humans. By the same token, Amazon. Are we keeping this as cost effective as we can? And are we delivering as quickly as we can? That's their strategy to succeed. Again, as you look through every single decision they therefore have to make about that strategy, some of it will come down to, oh my Lord, maybe we don't need all of those humans in a warehouse who make mistakes and put the wrong thing in the wrong box. Maybe we should get robots to do it. That's their culture operating to make their strategy a success. I think sadly, we always lump culture under this amorphous feel-good exercise where it's missing the critical component of, does your culture allow your strategy to succeed?
I really like the way you put that, because the one I always go to is Ryanair. And I always think of the Michael O'Leary-isms. I remember like one of them was hotels and conference facilities are an excellent source of free stationery. And it was, well, why are we buying paper for the office when we can just nick it when we travel and go to other places?
100%. But again, respectfully, you know, and I apologize for probably putting two behemoth organizations, Amazon and Walmart, in the frame. But there's a great Canadian example, Izzy Sharp and Four Seasons. If you look at that culture inherently embodied in the golden rule, anyone who's had the good fortune of staying at a Four Seasons anywhere in the world, and I would strongly recommend the Four Seasons in Asia to blow your mind in terms of customer and guest experience. Therein again is the culture that they've created, the culture that they've embodied, the people that they've hired, the training that those people have gone through, the diligence that they've put at every single moment, touch point of one human, an employee, with another human, a guest or the guest's family. They've sweated those details. And the ability for Four Seasons to be renowned time and time again as some of the best hotels in the planet is because it's their culture and the work that they've done. So taking it from there, my question to the city, to the province, to the government as it relates to Toronto is, what is the strategy for this city to make it the world-class destination we need it and want it to be? And do we have a culture that will enable that strategy to come to life in a legitimate, consistent, and in a compelling fashion? If we don't have a strategy, and we don't know the culture needed to make that strategy come to life, we're in the land of make-believe and dreams and wonderful political platitudes in front of a PR release.
It's funny because you're not alone. Most people that I've spoken to have talked about, like, what's the strategy? What's the story? Where are we going? Should this city have a chief creative officer? Like all these kind of things that come up in these conversations. But like to me, that's kind of gives me hope. Because actually, there's a fundamental keystone to the future that we're missing. And if we set that right, then we're probably on the right path. It also frightens me that, actually, how the hell do we not have one? Or if we do have one, how are we not communicating one? And I think that that's a really interesting thing of organizations that have great cultures typically have had a moment where shit's going wrong, and then they set themselves back straight again. I think that that's the thing that we have to look to as like the beacon of hope.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of spectacular points that you've made in there. At my optimistic, I imagine that there's a strategy for the city of Toronto. There has to be. I mean, I've got to presume by extension there's a strategy for the great country of Canada. I've got to assume that there is, because we've elected people for hundreds of years responsible for that strategy and guiding this country, this province, this city forward in a way that should be about us ultimately, and if I can use a commercial term, winning. What is our winning strategy? Again, I'll call out the spectacular Canadian Roger Martin, the godfather of strategy, Mr. Captain, playing to win. You don't have a strategy to exist in a market. You have a strategy to win in a market. And my question would be, what is our winning strategy? And critically, what does winning mean to us? You know, sadly, Toby at Shopify has recently come up with a wonderful quip that I hear way too often, that Canadians are happy with bronze and we have no desire to reach for silver or gold. I think there's an inherent pessimism in that comment, because I don't believe Canadians are comfortable with bronze. I think as it relates to the city of Toronto, we don't know what our gold is. I think we have a great sense of what gold might be for other cities, New York, Paris, Sydney, Shanghai, Tokyo. I'm not sure that we know what the unique gold of Toronto is, and more importantly, how we get to it. Because if we don't know what that is, again, we're dead in the water. If you don't know the destination, then any movement in any way is progress.
If it makes you feel better, I once worked at a Canadian client that had "aim for bronze" graffitied on their wall as a motivational statement. So
phenomenal. I very much look forward to them being third in their category time and again. That's spectacular. That's both inspirational and aspirational in one fell swoop. But Ian, all jokes aside, I've got to presume that there is a strategy for Toronto. I've got to hope that that strategy is one about making this a city that wins. My questions would be, what does winning look like for us? And therefore, if that's what winning looks like, what do we need to execute to get there? To date, I don't know. Unfortunately, in the week that's just passed, I've literally sat for 2.5 hours trying to get home on the TTC when we had the flash floods earlier this week. And between expletives and some colorful characters that were on the streetcar with me, a conversation for another podcast, I sat and wondered how a city like ours does not have something related to floods and extreme weather. Because again, this is not a new thing. It's something that we know is coming and something we seem very poorly prepared for. 24 hours later, I saw our prime minister comfortably dressed in a pair of chinos and a button-down white shirt, looking very egalitarian and of the common people, and our deputy prime minister talking about the biggest investment in transit across the country. I was overjoyed by what the project was, and I was significantly underwhelmed by how they both delivered what the project was intended to do and how it was going to happen. So yet again, it felt like a grand proclamation. It felt like a wonderful political placard, but the execution part was a big, gray, empty area. And it's in the execution that we succeed, not in the setting the destination.
It's interesting in the things that I've seen this week. So we had the floods. I then heard that I saw this on Twitter, that in 2018, the city council had a vote about doing something around stormwater control in the city and voted against it. Fast forward a few years and we have massive flooding. Admittedly, it was a bit of a freak weather event, but we're going to have more of them. We then have all the talk about the Gardner and how we could see this issue coming. And again, the execution of how to rebuild the Gardner is messy and it's not working, and we can point fingers and we're not going to do that here. But a few years before that, we had a mayoral election where a candidate said, I want to get rid of this because rebuilding it is going to cost us a lot of money. It's going to take a lot of time. And wouldn't it be nicer if we didn't have an elevated highway between the city and the lake? And she didn't win. Lots of people went, well, we're better the devil we know. We've always had the Gardner. Let's rehabilitate it. And now we're going through the issue that we're going through.
You mean we have a half-pregnant situation where we have elements of the Gardner just not out in the east end of the city, where 2/3 of the people trying to get into the city to work used to be able to do that conveniently and quickly.
Yeah, we end up with the worst of all worlds.
Or the tallest of midgets.
I'm going to steal that one. You touch on the TTC thing, which is like Trudeau turns up, announces a load of money. To me, that's a great thing, but there was nothing to sort of say, if you're going to announce $30 billion in transit funding, then cities can apply for it. Have one project, just one, where you can like, the first project going through this will be X. Look how pretty and shiny it is. Look at the utopia that we're working towards. Doesn't everybody want to jump on the bandwagon? I think it's really interesting that you call out Roger Martin as like the winning strategy guy. Perhaps the most Canadian trait going is we don't really want anybody to lose.
I think that's an interesting observation. You know, I say interesting. I think behind that, I could take it as that's incredibly pessimistic. I could also suggest it's probably incredibly accurate. I do think we're a country of universal healthcare, universal education, egalitarianism, unlike any other country on the planet. And I think we need to be proud of that fact. We don't like people to lose. The concern is in making sure that nobody loses, we get into the classic territory of everyone gets a participation badge and everybody is at the bottom of the bell curve. That's not accurate in terms of nature, in terms of humanity, in terms of society. I think we can recognize that you can win and that doesn't mean somebody else loses. But you can lose and nobody wins. And that would be the bigger concern. In ensuring that nobody loses, have we all inherently lost something? That would be my bigger concern, my bigger challenge, and my biggest disappointment if that was inherently what we stood for. And I don't believe it is, but I do believe that if we don't accept and don't expect to win and define what winning is, then I'm not entirely sure that we're ever going to make any progress whatsoever because it will be adequate and appropriate and entirely expected for politicians and people involved in urban planning and all the businesses that are involved to stand in front of a microphone and wave their hands and say some nice, pleasant, wonderful, platitudinous things. And we don't move a fucking inch forward. That, to me, is losing personified.
I sometimes struggle with strategy versus execution. Strategy is nothing without execution. The execution is the strategy too. When you come back to the, you assume we have a strategy, whether it's a winning one or not. When an organization is in a doldrum like this, whether it's a private corporation, whether it's a city, how do you start to pull yourself out? How do you go about going, is our strategy a winning one? And if not, how do we make one? And then turn that into something you can execute. Because this might sound really basic, but I think a lot of organizations don't know how to do that. Let's say we gave Hilton Barber the keys to the city for a bit.
Heaven forbid.
How would you go about steering that ship?
Spectacular question. And I thought we talked earlier about you were only going to ask me easy ones.
No, that's a lie.
Oh, there we go. So brand consistent then. Fantastic. In all seriousness, I think that's a spectacular question. I think you touched on part of it earlier when you talked about curiosity. I think inherently, if you're not curious as an individual, as a function inside a company, as an organization, a municipality, a city, a province, a country, if you're not curious about where do we want to go and how will we get there, or answer the question, where do we not want to go? And how do we avoid that happening? Then just doing nothing is wonderful because inherently that's safe. Any movement inherently, and we know this as individuals, any movement forward is inherently an exercise in change. And all cliches about change and how people hate change have a degree of truth in them. I think the larger truth about change is people are uncomfortable with change if they don't understand where and why that change is occurring. Change for the sake of change is incredibly disruptive. Purposeful change, well understood change, strategic change, change that inherently benefits, accelerates, or improves the state of the people involved. That is something that people can get behind. Dear friend Greg Sattell, who people on listening to this podcast likely follow on LinkedIn, talks about these movements And we can talk about them, whether it's the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, Elon Musk and going into space with SpaceX. Those are movements. Those require change. But the energy, the positivity, and invariably the better outcome was because people were galvanized, excited, enthused, and energetic about the change and didn't sit there and go, dear God, what are we doing? And why are you interrupting my comfortable state? That's, to me, the bigger problem. If we don't know where we're going again, we are dead in the water. Not only do we not know where we're going, but if we don't create a compelling story that brings people along, that engages them and says, imagine this better future for Toronto. Imagine what that would look like as a resident, as a tourist, as a business investor, as a company in another country is going, where would I invest my money and where would I find my talent? If we don't create that story and we don't make that story executable and we don't embody and enable and empower the cultures of the people responsible for making that happen to actually make it happen and make it safe. Again, back to what I said earlier. If the people making those decisions don't feel a degree of safety and security in saying, let's do this bold and courageous thing, and I won't have any negative repercussions, we will be the city we want to be. But if we don't have those elements, we don't have those ingredients, we are going to continue to fall on our face and we are going to continue to move forward in incremental, safe, and conservative ways. That will be a tragedy. That will be a travesty.
There's a Canadian bank ad campaign right now, and I normally pick on big Canadian banks as being utterly bland, utterly boring, but it talks about where will I be in 5 years? When it first came out, I didn't really care for it. It always feels like a little bit like you're trying to make a bank a hero where it's not really a hero. You want to do some goal setting or whatever it might be. But actually, it's asking a question of their customers. No, seriously, where do you want to be in 5 years? And I know it's the cliched
interview question.
Question where someone goes, well, I want to be in your job and you're going to be higher than me and I'm going to be behind that desk interviewing the next version of me. But I always find it interesting that some of the loudest voices around culture and change for the city are often talking about regressive steps. We don't want a bike lane because we want to have space for cars. We've always had space for cars. We should keep space for cars. We talk about things that mayors or leaders did in the past. It often struggles to be, what do we want this city to be in 5 years? What do we want Canada to be in 5 years? Which is really weird because we ask that of ourselves. We'd ask that of our employees. We'd ask that of our kids. Why don't we do it of the city? I find that like a really interesting thing of, and I don't know how to solve for that. Hopefully we'll figure it out. But I think that that's the really interesting piece of culture when it comes to where are we going? What is the change that we want? Because we're really good at saying this is shit. We're not very good at saying in 5 years we should be here.
I think that's a great observation. The bank that you're referencing, I too like the intent behind it because inherently what it's calling out is what are your ambitions? And that I think is a critical word. What are your ambitions personally? And how does the bank, how does this particular bank help you achieve or accelerate the achievement of those ambitions? My glib comment would therefore be, what are our ambitions for Toronto? Are we ambitious enough? Or do we just want to be a slightly cleaner version of who we are today? That's an ambition. I would suggest it's a small, tiny, and almost insignificant ambition. But we bandy around terms like world class.
I hate that term. Canadians always use it.
Oh, and look, and it's lovely and it makes for wonderful PR releases and T-shirts and coffee mugs and all this good stuff. But I would come back to, what is the size of our ambition? If we have an ambition and our ambition is mediocre, that's going to be okay for some people. But if we have a grand ambition, do we have the courage, the fortitude, the comfort with failing along that journey to know that these are steps towards a grander ambition? And I think this is probably the part for politicians where they struggle. I'm going to be presumptive here. But most grand ambitions aren't achieved within a political cycle. So are you ambitious enough? Are you courageous enough? Are you willing to set a grand ambition that may only be realized by the person who takes over from you, whether that's taking over as the CEO or taking over as the mayor or the prime minister? Or is your ambition curtailed by a 4-year election cycle in which inherently that means grand ambitions go out the door and incrementalism is the very best that we can hope for? That would be a courageous politician. That would be a courageous leader, being willing to abdicate their moment in the spotlight, their moment of accolades, to say, I set forth a grand ambition that two mayors after me were able to realize, but I set us on that path. That's my legacy. The starting of the project, not the finishing part where we unveil a statue.
I always think of this when it comes to like Boris bikes in London, because everyone called them Boris bikes, partly for alliteration, partly because Barclays were the sponsor and no one wanted to say the name of the sponsor. But it was never anything to do with him. It came from Ken Livingstone, who was like, bike shares are great. This is a good socialist policy. And to be fair to the guy, you've never really heard him screaming from the rooftop saying like, I did that, not Boris. Maybe it would have been a good thing if he did and we wouldn't have had a mess in the UK. But like, I think it's like that kind of, if you can accept that as a mayor and be like, look, I started loads of great things and I'm actually just happy that these things now exist. Maybe that's really, really easy for us to say as people who get to throw from the peanut gallery. I don't know, but it's huge.
Well, I'd go back to it the same as any great leader. What is the intent and the ambition and what is the legacy you seek to create in the company or organization that you lead? And are you able to subsume your ego long enough to recognize the bigger that ambition, the bigger that dream, the less likely it's going to happen on your watch, and be comfortable with that happening? That somebody else gets the accolades and somebody else, to your Boris bike example, gets to be the one that enters into popular culture. If you can lead like that, and if you can create a culture around you where the people share that ambition, share that aspiration, and recognize that big, bold, courageous, disruptive, transformative decisions, the echo of those decisions will be what the next generation of residents in the city get to enjoy. And if you can be a human that is comfortable with that approach, then there is nothing that should hold this city back, or by extension, this country back. But if we want to make sure that we get the accolades, we get the spotlight, we get the pats on the back, or we get the voters' tick in the ballot box, then we're always going to do something small. We're always going to do something easy. We're always going to do something comfortable. And we're always going to miss what we could have been.
If, let's say, you came to power, what big things would you want to do? Or let's say that you had the chance for the current mayor to see some of this through. What big changes would you try and initiate that maybe you don't get the credit for later?
That's a great question, Ian. I think it's a particularly heavy question for me, because I'm the father of two incredible daughters. So as I look at this city, as I look at some of the classic challenges we have now with affordability and housing and job prospects and all the dark and gloomy stuff that seems to take over the popular media, your question is one I grapple with. My family and I have chosen this city twice. We came here from Zimbabwe. I wanted to come to Toronto specifically. We then went and spent some time in the UK and had an opportunity to go to Asia. But we came back and again, we chose Toronto. So we've chosen the city. We saw it as a place of opportunity. We saw it as a place that had a bright future. I genuinely don't know what grand proclamations I would make or projects that I would move forward. But I do know that on the dimensions of housing, that is one that we cannot continue to mess up. We remain the magnet of immigrants from around the world. This city is the magnet to Canada. Or they will enter another port and recognize that the economic engine of the country is within a 100-mile radius of this city. Not surprisingly, they will come here. This is the 21st century version of Go West, Young Man, and Make Your Fortune. Come to Canada, come to Toronto. So if we don't address housing, transportation, and job growth, this will be a dystopian city in the future and not the utopian one that I honestly believe we could create. So those would be my three dimensions. What are we doing around job creation and not low-income job creation? Because I don't think the world needs 10,000 Uber Eats bike riders on our city streets. That is not job creation. That is not job security. What are we doing to house these people? And what are we doing to ensure that they can effectively, efficiently, and cost-effectively move around to the places where they live and the places that they work? So I recognize I haven't answered your question with a specific project, but those would be the three critical pillar foundational elements that I would want to be looking at first and foremost.
You pulled out a hard one. So lots of people say transportation. People have different views of what it looks like. Lots of people say housing. I think we have a reasonably solid view of it's not just units, it's the right housing. And we've talked about that on previous episodes of having places for families to live downtown. The job creation piece is really, that's hard. That is a really, really difficult one. But I think this is where we come back to the strategy thing of, we see a job as a job sometimes. So is that lots of people come here and become Uber Eats riders and it's not really creating value. But I think that what makes Toronto kind of a bit unique and a bit special, and it comes back to a lot of it is financial services, and our financial services culture has been really risk averse. We're still very proud that credit crisis didn't hit us in 2008, but we've never really ridden the growth that has come from banks that have rationalized investment firms that have, yes, they had to cut back and yes, they went through some austerity, but then they went, where does the next phase of growth come from? It was that pain of pruning led to new growth. I feel like we've never necessarily had that. We're still old growth, but we have to find ways that those jobs in a bank or those jobs in an investment company or a pension fund are not $90,000, which is above average salary, but isn't necessarily the ones that are reinventing how finance works. And we have to be the ones that lead on that so that if you're one of the world's best bankers or if you're a fantastic person when it comes to thinking about capital design, and we had someone on the podcast talking about this, you're doing it in Toronto. You're not doing it. Like, Toronto is competitive against New York, against Frankfurt, against London, against Amsterdam, against Asia when it comes to this stuff. And I think like that's really hard to do, and it's not something that falls on a mayor or a mayor alone.
Sure.
If we get that right, it opens up the wealth that we can then spend on transportation, housing, etc.
100%. But again, I believe that no one is naive enough that's listening to this podcast to think that this sits on the shoulders of the mayor or the shoulders of the people at Queen's Park or, heaven forbid, Parliament Hill. This is a shared accountability. This is a shared responsibility. I mean, we all choose to live here. We all choose to contribute to this city. Ideally, those who are able contribute in a way that's accretive and grows the pie for all and doesn't just look at recent changes in our capital gains to suggest that maybe it's the time to leave Canada. Again, conversation for another podcast. But I think it's incredibly selfish. In fact, I think it's incredibly childish to bemoan how our city is without looking to yourself and saying, people simplistically come to a city for one of two reasons, to visit or to do business. And to do business inherently means that they will choose to live there if that's a place in which they can do business. So what are we doing to create a thriving, multidimensional? You mentioned financial services. That's easy. Yes, you can look down to Bay Street and see a bunch of really tall, expensive steel and glass buildings. But what other businesses are we creating to bring talent, to bring creativity, to bring ambitious people who they themselves want to grow and develop and add and build? What are we doing to bring them to the table, to bring them to the city versus going to Montreal or Calgary or Vancouver or, heaven forbid, going to a city that is not Canadian? That would be my question to every listener. What is your contribution to making this a city that we can all be proud of in 5 years' time, in 20 years' time? And a place for those of us who have children to say, There is no other city in the world I would rather bring up my family, knowing that they have a decent and bright future. If we don't have that ambition and we don't realize our obligation and our accountability to that, then it becomes a very easy exercise of shouting from the peanut gallery and throwing shit and saying, oh, our politicians are crap. You want a different Toronto? What are you doing about it? And I do, and I applaud the fact that this podcast and the guests, the other guests, certainly not me, but the other guests that you've had have recurringly made that point. This can't be something we abdicate to some people who we elect every 4 years. This is something that each and every one of us has to be doing each and every day. If not, you're just being lazy and complacent, and you get what you deserve if you're lazy and complacent. And damn, I now sound like my father.
We all turn into our dads, unfortunately.
Heaven forbid.
Love you, Dad. I like to end these things on the note of, if you have a magic wand, and I know we sort of touched on, like, if we made Hilton the benevolent dictator at some point during this conversation.
Is benevolent a critical aspect of that, or can we change that? Sorry, I'm just channeling my daughters when I say that.
Well, what I want to say is, like, if you had the magic wand around what you could do to this city, whether that's to make it better as a city or just to make it the place that you want your daughters to be living in and thriving in 5, 10, 20 years' time, what would your wish be with the magic wand?
I go back to an earlier part of this podcast and you talked about it. Culture. The culture of the people that live here, the people that are accountable and responsible for the city. Creating a culture where, for those, and let's maybe call them dreamers, in the immortal words of Mr. John Lennon, imagine that we had a culture across the city. We're being courageous. We're being bold. We're being ambitious. We're reaching for gold versus being satisfied with bronze. Was something not only we aspired to, but is something that was inherently safe and expected of us. That we looked to our politicians and said, what brave, courageous, transformative thing have you done today? Versus let them get off with, what easy, incremental, and safe thing did you do today? That would be my magic wand. That would be the culture I would want to imbue inside our city, inside our municipalities, inside our province, and inside our government at large. Live into an ambition and be courageous enough to recognize that you may offend. Again, heaven forbid. You may offend, you may ostracize, and you may piss off elements, but that's okay. Every bold and ambitious thing ever done had detractors and naysayers, but it was done anyway. Be that person. Create that culture. Let those behaviors, let those decisions be what we look for, be what we aspire for, and therefore be what we are able to create here in Toronto, here in Ontario, and here in Canada.
I love that note to end it on, Hilton. It's very strong, but I wholeheartedly agree with so much as you thought that through. So that we're not thinking about this as I made the safe choice. Even if you look a bit silly for making the bold thing that might not necessarily work out perfectly, it's better to have tried that. And to, I'll end it on a cliche of Gretzky. Again, Canadian. All comes back to the Canadians of, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So whether we want to attribute that to Wayne Gretzky or Michael Scott, I don't know. Perhaps both. I have it printed on my desk. It was a gift from my wife when I started my own thing. But that attitude of being bold, not being afraid to go and make a mistake, to be distinctive, whether it, even if it pisses some people off, that's where all the good stuff comes from. So let's build that culture.
I certainly hope so, because this genuinely could be a golden city. We need to stop being comfortable with it being bronze laden.
Nobody wants bronze. We're not going to celebrate too many bronzes at the Olympics this summer. We're going to celebrate gold. We'll remember the gold medalists. We don't remember the bronze ones.
Amen, brother. Go Team Canada.
There we go. I've got the passport. I can support them officially now. Thanks, Hilton.
Ian, always a pleasure. And again, my thanks to you and to the other guests that have stepped into this podcast. I've so appreciated their energy, their enthusiasm, their aspirations. It's a delight to be part of this project, and I certainly hope it gains momentum, traction, and actually comes to life in real ways. So thank you, Ian, for everything that you're doing, and appreciate the invitation, mate.
Thank you, mate. Well, we'll speak soon, or we'll grab a beer.
That's fantastic.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Challenger City TO podcast. You can find written up versions of all these interviews, as well as a history of the other podcasts we've done to date, if you go to challengercityto.substack.com. We'll see you again for another episode very soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.